Let me preface by saying that while I call this an in-depth course looking at primary sources, I do not for the life of me expect that we're going to do anything more than scratch the surface. This is as deep as the ocean, and at best we can get a few teaspoons of water in, not much more than that. But at least we'll begin to see some of the issues, and so I'm going to select them. I also want to make sure that you understand that we are not going to do the whole book of Bereshit in 7 weeks. We are going to be taking issues in Parashat Bereshit and some in the Noach, and not much more than that, if at all. You understand? We'll get as much as we can get done within that. But at least to be able to, where we do go, get a good sense that we're getting a grip of what it is that's happening. Before I begin, and in your sources, you know that we begin by looking at the first pasuk, and we look at the very first pasuk of the Torah in light of Rashi. You will, of course, notice if you're opening up a Chumash that I'm jumping right into the middle of Rashi because I skipped the very first, very famous Rashi of Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. I didn't want to go into it because Rashi in elsewhere told us, Eini ba ela lepshuto shel mikra, I'm only interested in the pshat. And clearly in his first comment, he does anything but pshat. Now, Rashi will cite midrashim throughout. But when he cites midrashim, he presumes that the midrash is the proper understanding of the pshat. I want to explain that pshat is not literal. The word, the simple meaning, takes into account that language, all language, is metaphorical. All languages has nuance. All language uses not only dry meaning of words the way you would put them on a page, but has intonation, has inflection, and you can turn a statement into a question or a declaration, or if you like, even a rhetorical question by exaggerating how you would read it and therefore make it almost into something nonsensical. So Rashi looks at all of those things as well. And when the Medrash did it, it did it as well. When Rashi opened his commentary with a very famous statement of Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, everybody asked the question, why is Rashi doing this when in fact his entire purpose seemed to have been to go to explaining the pshat to us, as he did in the Gemara, as he did elsewhere. Historians argue that Rashi was operating within his history. Well, let me explain. Rashi lived at the end of the 11th century, and in 1096 was the First Crusade. And Rashi lived through the First Crusade, which devastated the communities around him. Up until the Crusades, because of the Augustinian perspective, Jews lived in Western Europe in relative serenity. They were not second-class citizens. They were not citizens at all. They had no protection under the law. They were deemed as third or fourth-class citizens at best. There were occasional cases of violence, but not systemic, because the church under Augustus took the position that the very existence of the Jew in a downtrodden manner, needing to pay Jew tax, needing to wear special garments that mark him as an infidel, was proof positive that the Jews were the accursed people who had failed to recognize the true Savior, and therefore they would serve as a living example to the Christians amongst them, why not to go against the church's teachings? All that changed with the Crusades. With the Crusades, the original purpose was to marshal both the common folk, the peasantry, under the leadership of the church, which by now has become very powerful, and are the largest landowners, and are in fact hand in hand with the aristocrats and the governments to such a degree that you almost don't know who's who. There's not a separation here between church and state. The church is the state. And there's not a separation between the state and the land ownership, or if you like, the wealth. They are the wealth, they are the government, and they are the key, if you like, to God. And when they became so very powerful, they marshaled the common folk to be able to take back the Holy Land. The Holy Land which had been conquered by the Muslims. We have on the one hand the world of Islam, which frankly, as scientifically is concerned, were far superior to the Christians in Europe. Their marshaling of technology, their marshaling of mathematics, and their, if you like, revival of the Greek classics and the study of science was way above anything that was happening in France or Germany, and certainly of England, which was frankly rather benighted. And Islam posed a tremendous threat to Christendom. As a result, they began their major crusade to take back the Holy Land. But on the way, since the idea was to conquer the land and kill the infidel, the peasantry said, why go all the way to the far to the Middle East when we have infidels amongst us? So Rashid lives through the first pogrom of 1096, which has at least 12,000 Jews murdered in Alsace-Lorraine, near the area of Worms and Mainz, not far from where he lives. And the relative peaceful coexistence between Jewish scholars and their Christian counterparts is all thrown apart. So some historians argue that that famous Rashi, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, was intended to establish, not for them, but for us, that be the land in the hands of the Muslims, or be it now in the hands of the Christians, all that is irrelevant, because the only ones that have the rights with an unbreachable covenant are the Jews, both to the Torah and to the land of Eretz Israel. The original conquest of the Holy Land by the Christians posed a theological crisis for many Jews. And it was important for Rashi to, in a sense, emphasize that whoever is holding it now is holding it just for a little while. It remains ours because the land is his. And that's why we need to begin the Torah with establishing that Hashamayim LaHashem, and God created Haaretz, and he will give it to whoever he sees fit. And since he made the covenant with Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, that covenant is unbreachable and is not overtaken by the new covenant, which in other words is called the New Testament. You see, the church argued that the New Testament made us irrelevant, cursed, and they now have the rights to it. Therefore, Terashi, according to many historians, needed first and foremost to establish that before he went down to the nitty-gritty. So now we're going to go down to the nitty-gritty. The nitty-gritty is that the Torah begins with Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. And in your Sefer Torah, the Bereshit begins with a big bet. And not merely because this was a stylistic kind of way of scribing it. Chazal tell us that the bet has a tiny little thing that points upward in the upper part of the bet. And at its foot, distinguishing it from a kaf, it has a little foot that points backwards. And that is to say, who created you? With one thumb, you're going to point upward. And when did it all happen? Way back when. You're going to point to the back. But more importantly, the Torah did not begin with Aleph. When it says that it didn't begin with Aleph, and I gave you a series of Midrashim, there is no verse in the entire Torah that has more Midrashim than this one. Chazal tell us as follows, it didn't begin with Aleph, because Aleph is one. And Aleph is one is because before there was a world, there is an Aleph. And in Kabbalistic writings, in Midrashic writings, Aleph stands for God himself. But there is another Medrash that tells us that before this world, that is number Bet, number two, there was a world of Aleph, and the word Aleph, Elef, also means a thousand. So we are told as follows. Before there was this world as we know it, there were Elef Olamot, a thousand worlds, prior to the world that we know you, this one. And therefore, any questions that you have about what your paleontologists will tell you when they dig it up and what happened beforehand is utterly and completely irrelevant. Furthermore, a Medrash tells us the shape of Bet is critical. It is close to the top. It is close to the back. It is close to the bottom. And it tells you, don't ask about what's above you. Don't ask what's beneath you. Don't ask what came before this world. We are going to move forward from now on in forward. We move forward from the world as we know it. And when we start the world as we know it, we make a declaration. Bereshit bara Elokim. The world as you know it has not always been here, as the Greeks argued. You see, to the Greeks, the world, the physical world that you know, is the eternal world. It's always been here, and therefore it is in fact the God. The world that you know around you, the physical world, both the explored and the unexplored worlds that are around you, were created by God, a God that is immutable, that is eternal, and cannot be conceived of. So when we look at this, we need to ask a series of questions, and those are some of the questions that Rashi would have asked. Rashi, when he begins his pshat, reads this pasuk, and he says, Ein hamikra hazeh omer ela darsheni. This text that we are reading, the very first verse that we are reading, says to us, you must speak about me. You cannot take me on face value as is anymore. And I will use a very vulgar metaphor. If I were to speak to you and tell you it's raining cats and dogs, and you just came from Mars, and you took me literally, you would go outside and expect to see cats and dogs flying out of the heavens, right? But when I say cats and dogs, I don't mean for one minute anything of the kind. I mean that it is a downpour, that it's a deluge, that it is a horribly strong rain, don't I? It's just an expression, because people talk this way. We speak, our language is perforce always metaphorical. Because when we need to explain or discuss something which is not tangible, for which we can give a name, a noun, a person, a place, a thing, when it is in fact an abstract thing, the only thing I can call it is by something similar to something which you can grasp. So I call him Elohim. I refer to God as Elohim. The Shoresh is El. In Hebrew and in all Semitic languages, Ein la El Yadi, which means I haven't got it in my power. My hand is not doing what it should do. I haven't got the wherewithal. El means power, force. Now, you cannot see force. You cannot see energy. You can't hold it in your hand. Why then would we call him Elohim, plural? Because what I can see, what I am aware of, is multiple powers. Now, I'll explain to you by the mashal that I always gave my students. What you can see is my fingers are moving. And you will tell me that this is a fact, that my fingers are moving, correct? Is it true that my fingers are moving? And the answer is, of course it is. But it's a lie. It's an illusion. My fingers can't move. I am moving my fingers. But you can't see I. So what I see is a multiplicity of forces in the world. There is the power of gravity. There is the power of the wind. There is the power of the tide. There is the power of the sun's rays. There are powers that I cannot even begin to see. You all know about it. It's called electricity. There are forces beyond us, because we all know that we are hearing you're hearing my voice, and it's being transmitted via radio waves, but you can't see magnetic radio waves. That doesn't mean that they don't exist. And yet the notion somehow, when I use the singular bara and I say Elohim, I indicate that all of these forces of nature are one. I am describing the phenomenological reality of the way a human being experiences it. So I am telling you that all of the forces of nature are those that we see and those that we do not see, those that are here in our world and those that transcend this world, are unified. And they were created Bereshit, which poses our first major problem, to which now I will share. In this pasuk, we have two words. One of them is called a milot. It means it's a mini word, and it usually appears as a prefix. It's the very first one. It's the bet. And you see the shape of the bet, right? Bet, bereshit, can mean by means of, such as, ani kotevet be'et, I am writing. In English, you would say, with a pen. Ani nosat barechev, which is now a double entendre, because it can also mean betoch, in. Right? Yeshli kafe betoch hakos, bakos, in the cup. And I can use it to indicate bishvil. Bishvil means for the sake of. So Yaakov tells Lavan, I spoke to you berachel bitcha haktana. I spoke to you for, I intended to marry somebody else. This is what I did it for. And if that's the case, the meaning of our verse can be as follows. With Reshit, God created the world. In Reshit, God created the world. And then we have to plan out what the word is Reshit mean. For Reshit, God created the world. If it's for Reshit, as Rashi argues, כמו שדרשוהו רבותינו זיכרונם לברכה, as our sages had already explicated, בשביל התורה, God created the world for the Torah, which was also called in the book of Mishlei, Reishit Darko, the beginning of his ways. ובשביל ישראל, and for the sake of Israel, that were called Reishit Tvuato, his first crop. Or, as some had argued in other Midrashim, with, not for, Reishit, Reishit Chochma, the beginning of wisdom. With wisdom, with the wisdom, and what is the greatest wisdom of all? With the Torah. Therefore, they tell us, Istakel beoraita uvara alma. He looked inside the Torah and created the world, which means that the Torah came before the world, as we know it. Do you see that all three meanings can equally be there? But once you've translated it, you're stuck with one or the other. Whereas Hebrew is like a diamond. It depends on the facet you're holding. And it can mean all of these things at the very same time. Rashi then will then point out another problem we have. Reishit is a nismach. Now I'll explain what a nismach is. Hebrew is a very, very parsimonious language. I mean by that it is very tight. When you translate Hebrew to English, you need to calculate that it's going to take 65 to 100% more space. When I translate 100 pages from Hebrew, I get between 165 and 200 pages in English to say the same thing. Very brief. When I take the word bayit, I have a house. When I want to attach it to something else, it moves from two syllables, bayit, to one syllable, and it becomes bait. Bait means the house of. And then I add a word. Beit Sefer becomes school. Beit Knesset becomes a shul. Beit Cholim becomes a hospital. That's called nismach, when I attach it to something else. Therefore, the word reishit means the head of. Rosh, head of. Now, the head can be the beginning or the most important thing. It doesn't necessarily mean the beginning. It can mean at the pinnacle. At its height, God created the heavens and the earth. Or it can mean in the beginning. Depends on how you look at the Rosh. Because I have two words for beginning in Hebrew. Rishona or Tchila. And it doesn't say Behatchala. It says instead Reishit. So it means at the pinnacle of, at the apex of, or at the beginning of what? And there is no word attached. Comes Rashi and tells us as follows. Im bata lefarsho kipshuto. But if you want a simple meaning, as opposed to the one he just gave me, kach parshehu. Here's how I want you to translate it. Bereshit briyat shamayim va'aretz. In the beginning of the creating of the heavens of the earth. In the beginning of the creating of the heavens of the earth was tohu vavohu vechoshech al pnei tehor vayomer Elokim yehi or. Argues Rashi that pasuk aleph, bet, gimel are all one long sentence. And it should be read, in the beginning of creating the heavens and the earth was tohu vavohu, which we'll deal with this, and darkness was all over the depths, and the Spirit of God was hovering or fluttering over the face of the waters. And at that point, God said, let there be light. One long, long sentence. And then he adds, Velo baha mikra. And let me make it clear, he says, scriptures don't come to tell you, Seder HaBriya, to tell you the order in which they were created. Lomar she'ele kadmu, to tell you that these came first. Which came first? Ha'aretz v'ashamayim. Because if that was the case, how can you make reference to the depths, to the ruach, to the water, to the choshech? Hasn't even been defined yet. Hasn't been created yet. Mashma that they were already created. Because how can you say that the Spirit of God was over the waters? Where do the waters come in? And how can you speak about the depth, the darkness? Or is the darkness nothing more than the absence of light? But how can you speak about tehom, which means the depths, and usually means the depths of the sea? Do I have the seas already? Or am I talking about dimension? Ah, he says, no, then we have a problem. He says, it's not in the order that we thought it was. This is not telling me the order. All it's telling me is that on the very first breath, God created what? Or, aretz, shamayim, mayim, tehom, choshech, it all there, all at the same time, all the same breath. And we don't know in what order, because it was all tohu vavohu, one big mishmash. What Rashi did not discuss, but the Medrash does, is that little word et, bereshit bara Elokim, et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz. I venture to say that the word et is the most extant word in the entire Torah, and it has no equivalent in English. So your English translations simply fudge it. They don't bother putting it in. It is not an article. It's not a. It is not a definite article. It's not the. And you know that all Hebrew words come from a three-letter root, except some words that have a four-letter root where you have two letters repeated, like tzartzar. But otherwise, they all come from a three-letter root. The word et functions usually as an ot, aleph, vav, taf. And an ot means a letter, a sign, ototu moftim. And you have how many otiyot in the Hebrew alphabet? Please notice that the word et is the aleph and the taf. Not more, not less, right? It's the beginning and the end. And it's an ot, means a letter, a sign, a symbol. And because it's a sign, it actually can serve as an arrow. And it connects the verb to its object, such as shatiti et hakafe. Et hakafe shatiti. Achalti et halechem. And it simply connects it, because Hebrew can be read this way and this way. And since you can read it both ways, and you can put the verbs and the predicate and the subject either way, so I stick the et in front of the object of the verb. Therefore, Bereshit bara Elokim, what did he create? Et ha-shamayim. But I don't need ve'et ha'aretz a second time. It's enough to say, Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve'ha'aretz. And we need to account for every word, for every letter, for every nekuda in the Torah. Nothing there is extraneous. So we need to understand that the word et also can come from the shoresh ant. Now you understand why the vav would drop, because the vav is silent. You don't say avat. You say ot. It's silent, so it can fall. Ant, the nun falls, because a taf at the end of a word is not sof, like the Ashkenazim say. And it's not taf, like the Sfardim say. It's thaf, th, like the Taimanim still say. When you take an n and you make it with a th, umph, it's hard to say, the nth degree. So it falls. Therefore, when you have the word natan, he gave, how do you say it in past tense? Not natanti, the nun drops, and you say natati. And you put a dagesh to indicate a letter is missing. The word ant is most similar to the German und, and in English, and. And it means along with. Rabbi Akiva was the first shedarash et ha'itim. He's the first one that explained them. So when it says kabed et avicha ve'et imecha, it means honor your father and everybody that comes along with him, and your mother and everybody that comes along with her. That includes your father's new wife. That includes your big brother, your big sister. It includes your grandparents. It's the ganze chamula that comes along with them, and everybody that comes along with them. Ant. Ant means along with. And that's why it can say, et ha'elokim hitalech Noach, which is translated as Noach walked with God. We will yet talk about the difference between et, when it means and, along with, and im with ein, which means with. One of them is a schlepper, comes along with, but is not the ikel, is not the main thing. And with, im, is side by side, both of them being full subjects. Okay, so we have to account, what did God create? Et ha-shamayim ve-et ha-aretz. As a result, comes along the Ramban. The Ramban al Torah wants us to understand a few critical things, and I want to read it with you, and then we're going to answer some questions, okay? HaKadosh Baruch Hu bara kol hanivraim me'afisa muhletet. Because of the words et, that is otherwise unnecessary, explains the Ramban, and he's not deviating from Chazal at all. He is, in fact, completely in line with the Zohar and with very, very ancient writings that we have. God created all things from a complete zero, ephes. In other words, ex nihilo, from nothing. Something from nothing. Ve'ein etzleinu belashon hakodesh behotza'at hayesh me'ain ela lashon bara. Create in Hebrew, bara, not yatzar, not asa, but bara is used only to indicate making something from nothing. Ve'ein kol ha'nesa tachat ha'shemesh olemala. Nothing that was made in the heavens above or below or anywhere else. Have min ha'ayin hatchala rishona. Started from the very beginning, from nothing. And what does he always tell us? Aval hotzi min ha'efes ha'gamur, but he took out from the absolute nothingness. Yesod dak me'od. God first made a very tiny, minuscule matter, which the Greeks called prime matter, but they spoke in a different language than we do. Ein bo mamash. It has virtually no substance. Aval hu koach mamzi. But within it is the ability to create and make other things happen. And it is ready to accept and make forms from it and come out from potential to actuality. V'hu ha-chomer ha-rishon, and it was the first matter. God made on that first day the matter from which the heavens and the earth were made. Nikra la-yevanim hiyoli. I don't speak Greek. He says the Greeks called it hioli. In translation, it means prime matter. V'acharei ha'hioli lo bara davar. Once he created that prime matter, God did not create anything more, something out of nothing. Ki mimeno himtzi hakol. Because from that prime matter, he made all things and built them, created them, formed them. You will later on see the word bara appear again. Only when we have something completely new that didn't exist before added. And that is the leap that no one has been able yet to pinpoint from vegetation to animal and from animal to man. When I have something that has never existed before coming out of nowhere, that cannot be explained through any kind of evolutionary processes. I use the word bara. And therefore, what does he tell us? Achar she'amar b'tchila b'ma'amar echad, since he tells us in the very beginning, bara Elokim hashamayim v'ha'aretz v'chol tzva'am, God created the heavens and the earth and all of their hosts. The host means everything that comes along with it. Chazar u'piresh. First he gave you a general statement, and then he broke it down and told you that after that first initial creation of prime matter, haita tohu, this matter, substance, he says, this matter, and gradually he made it bohu. Bohu means he gave it form. And what then was created initially with this prime matter? Esh, mayim, afar, ve'avir. Umilat ha'aretz, and the word for land, tichlol arbat ele, includes all four of these, which means et ha'shamayim, that first et, is the letter ot, and the second ve'et ha'aretz is ha'aretz and everything that comes with it, which means fire, water, earth, and air. All of those were initially created, but how did they appear? They appeared as a plasma, a liquid plasma, a mishmash in which nothing was all mixed together. And he says, and if you insist that the word be means bishvil, fully conscious of Rashi's presentation, he says, I want you to know that the reason it doesn't say Elokim bara bereshit is that rather the word bereshit tirmoz b'chokhma. God created it with a wisdom, an intelligence. And that is a word that stands on its own and is not attached to anything else. And that's why he goes and says, go there and see in the Yerushalmi. They treat the word Bereshit, they say, with wisdom. God created the heavens and the earth. I want you to look carefully at the questions I asked you. In his commentary to Bereshit, the Malbim asks the question, Im barishona bara shamayim v'aretz shu kolel hakol, if in the beginning God created heavens and earth and everything in it, which means he created it all, what did he do afterwards? Why do I need the rest of the story? You indicated that there's a creator. It comes from him. Everything here is his and comes from him. Why do I need the rest of the story? I want you to think about that. I want you to think not only
Do you want to comment now? Or do
you can comment now because I know how Rashi would respond to it and I know how Ramban would respond to it. Tell me what you think.
Well, otherwise you have deism. If you don't have the rest of the story, you can have this God that makes the original stuff and then leaves the world. And since we don't want to believe that that's what happened, that God is not only the creator, but that he's in history and constantly involved with it, you have to show that.
Good. Now I want to ask you the following. Couldn't I accomplish the same thing by skipping to chapter 2? Think about it for a moment. Just think. I want you to go home. I want you to look at it, the whole thing, and tell me if you couldn't accomplish that by simply skipping to chapter 2.
Don't you want to show the importance of human beings? And if you skip... Or chapter 2, you mean chapter 2 in Bereshit, not Parshat Noah. Okay.
No, Parshat Bereshit. Yeah.
Okay.
I want you to think about that. Number 2, I want you to look carefully at Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch's answer as to why we need to know that originally the earth was tohu vavohu. Why do we need to know that? Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, and I don't have an English translation, but Ha'aretz hazot shelefaneinu hayom, the earth as we know it, the earth in front of us, and the stars that we can see, and whatever exploration we make in outer space, על כל יצוריה ופרטיה בייחודם הממוחלט. For all of their details, for all of the creatures and objects that we can find them. I want you to know that in the past, they were formless. They had no shape. And they had no life in them. But he adds something else to us. Ve'ilu ne'emar kan v'tehi ha'aretz tohu v'vohu. Had it been written, v'tehi ha'aretz tohu v'vohu, as opposed to v'ha'aretz haita tohu v'vohu, it would have been a continuation of the first verse. But it is not a continuation. He says, unlike Rashi and Rashbam, that verses 1, 2, and 3 are all set together in one long breath, one long sentence. He says, no, we have two facts here. Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim et ha-aretz. Period. That's it. Ve-ha-aretz hayta. So now I need to teach you a little bit lesson in Hebrew grammar. Rashi doesn't say it here. Esther Shkup is pointing you to Rashi in the fourth chapter. The fourth chapter begins as follows. Ve'ha'adam yada et chava ishto. In biblical Hebrew, you put first the verb, the predicate, then the noun. Vayomer Moshe. Vayelech Avraham. The vav is not an and, contrary to all of your stupid translations. Vav is a multiple function word. Vav can be and, it can be but, it can be however, but, and it has a grammatical function to take the form that is future, yelech, and flips it into past tense. Vayelech means went. Yelech means he will go. Vayelech, he went. Past tense. If I say in biblical Hebrew, Vayelech Avraham, I translate it, Avraham went. Chuck the ands. But if I say in biblical Hebrew, Ve'Avraham halach, it does not mean and Abraham went. It means that it's a perfect tense. I know your eyes are rolling. You loved grammar. He had gone. If it said Ve'Avraham holech, it's a perfect tense, but it's present perfect. Avraham has been going, started it then, still doing it. But if it's past perfect, it was way back then, way before. Says Rashi, Kvar kodem ha'inyan shel mala, way before the thing that happened beforehand. Kodem shechata v'nitrad migan Eden. V'chen ha'herayon v'haleida. Why is that crucial? Let me explain. Why did Rashi make a fuss about here and not there? Because Rashi was working in a context that was historical, namely the church. The church argued that the first sin was what? The apple? Nah. Sex. And as a result, all human beings are conceived in sin. And are damned to hell unless they're saved. Came Rashi and wanted you to understand that Avraham yada. Avraham had already known. Why is this crucial? Because chapter 1 tells you the story of creation. Chapter 2 focuses on the creation of man. Chapter 3 is the original sin. Chapter 4 speaks about the birth of Cain and Hevel. And he wants to make sure that you understand that the conception and the pregnancy and the birth happened way before the sin. That's why he's making such a fuss about it. Because he was arguing against church theology. He wasn't only arguing about the grammar, because he thought that the grammar was self-evident to you. He didn't know that you didn't know stupid grammar. Here he needed to make a fuss. Now, as a result, if I say v'ha'aretz hayta, it means the earth had been tohu vavohu. How long? Duh. Right. Because there's no such thing as time. Because time is a function of the motion of the stars and the moon and the earth. around its own axis, around the sun to make a year, the moon's cycles to make a month. Lo haya velo nivra, they don't show up until the fourth day. Time has no meaning. So I can't even say in the beginning of time God created the earth and the heavens, because there's no time yet. I can't say bereshit hakol, in the beginning of everything, because there's nothing. There's nothing yet. And as a result, what are we being told here? The haaretz and the earth had been tohu vavohu v'choshech al pnei tehom way before God came along and said. And said means what? Wanted. Yehi'ol v'yehi'ol. Is that sunlight? How could it be? There's no sun yet. Then what does it mean when he calls it day? And what does it mean when he calls the darkness night? Isn't it all metaphorical? Mustn't it really be metaphorical? It must indeed. Because it otherwise makes no sense. Comes Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch and tells you that's exactly right. I want you to know that the heavens and the earth that you knew see around you were originally, for a very long time, we don't know how long, we don't know what this time was, because there is no time yet. It's before time. Had no shape, had no form, it was a plasma. Ve'ilu ha'pasuk ha'sheni. The first one is way beyond our time. The second one ignores the heavens and just tells us v'ha'aretz. Lama? Ki ha'shamayim shamayim la'Hashem. V'ha'aretz natan livnei adam. What does the word shamayim? Now comes another word. What is shamayim? Shamayim. Heaven? Sky? There is no singular for shamayim. Shamayim, says Sforno, comes from the root sham, there. And is one of those words that's a double word, ayim, ayin, einayim, yad, yadayim, regel, raglayim, shen, shinayim. Things that come in pairs, and not im, but ayim. Where is heaven? There, and there, and there, and there, and there. Proving from Lashon HaKodesh that the earth is round. And how far does it go? Who knows? Who knows? But it's the there. And Haaretz is the hair. The here and now. And the here and now as you know it is not the way it was. Comes the Kli Yakar centuries later and tells us why it's crucial that we know this. It's crucial not only so that we justify it in light of modern science. It's crucial that we understand that the Torah has a lesson for us here. And he tells us, Va'aretz haita tohu vavohu. Umat zorech biyidiyazu. What need is there for this knowledge? Nira lomar lefi shemisheshet yimei bereshit ve'ala. From the first 6 days of creation that we will read about in the rest of the chapter, nothing has been changed from the way it was, essentially. You will soon see that there's words that are, it says that it was so, and sometimes it does not say so. That's going to be your homework assignment. V'tzafa kadosh baruch hu, and the Ribbono Shel'Olam saw, She'al yedei ma'asei ha'resha'im, by virtue of free will, evil people can turn the world back and revert it back to tohu vavohu, kemo bedor ha'mabul, as it was in the age of the story of the deluge, which means that the default of our world is tohu vavohu. And embedded in the material world is a tendency for decomposition and chaos. Things are always falling apart, dying, and reverting to chaos, the primary way that God made the world. V'chen b'churban ha'bayit. And that's why when the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, Yirmiyahu says, Ra'iti et ha'aretz v'hinei tohu. I saw the land, and it was, and for lack of another word, I'm using the Greek word, chaos. V'hodia lanu ha'katuv. And so the Torah, the scripture, is teaching us and is informing us. She'im yikre bizman min hazmanim. If it should ever happen in any of the times, she'al yedei ma'ase ha'resha'im yachzor ha'olam letohu, should the world revert back and self-destruct, if you like, back to a state of tohu, it will not be considered a change. Babriya. There's no change. Ela yachzor ha'olam lekemot shehaya. It will go back to what it was originally. It'll go back to tohu vavohu. That will explain Chazal's statement. There were 1,000 worlds before ours, and they all self-destructed to tohu vavohu. That's the state, the default. Kimitivo, because by its nature, it's programmed to go back to tohu vavohu vechoshech. Ve'al yedei ma'asei hatzadikim, and by the action of righteous, good people, asa hakadosh baruch hu hefech tivo, the Ribbono Shel Olam allowed humanity to do the opposite and prevent the dissolution, melting. Ubara ha'or latzadikim. Therefore, tells us the Zohar, et ha'or, that God made, vayar, right? God saw et ha'or, he saw the light. How much is it? Aleph is how much? One. Taf is 401, right? Hey.
Hi.
Aleph, one. Vav, six. Resh is 200. Do the math quickly. 613. The light. Human soul is a candle. The Torah, or. And it's the Torah that is the light. It's not the sun. It's not the moon. And when there is light, God calls it day. And when there is night, which means that there is no goodness in the world, God calls it Laila. So when you ask the question, Ma nishtana halayla hazeh mikol halaylot, you're asking, why is this lack of Shechina, lack of goodness, the darkness that has befallen the earth, why is it different from other nights? This night is a lack of light, and the light is goodness in the world. And so it is up to man to bring light into the world or to extinguish that light that's in the world. That's why it is called good, as opposed to something else. It is not the sunlight. And therefore, it is a moral lesson and not at all a lesson in physics. This is not all about where the universe began, you know, how it was created, but for us to understand how fragile the universe in which we are is and how much of it depends on us. That's why Bereshit Rabba tells us, Ve'aretz haita tohu elu ma'asehem shel reshaim. These are the deeds of cruel, evil people. Vayomer Elokim yihi or, let there be light, elu ma'asehem shel tzadikim. What I would like you all to do for next week's session is to go for the rest of the chapter and see what's common and what's different in every day of creation. What language is used in each one of those? Such as, does the word bara appear, vayomer, kitov, vayichen, and any of those words.